Asian Pacific Expression.
Community and cultural coverage.
Music and calendar.
New visions and voices.
Coming to you with an Asian Pacific Islander point of view.
It's time to get on board the Apex Express.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's South Asia Spotlight on Apex Express. I am your host and producer, Preeti Mangalashekar. Tonight, we revisit the widely discussed, shared and reshared hashtag MeToo campaign, but through a recent disturbing incident involving feminist ally and media personality Aziz Ansari. Find out on tonight's South Asia Feminist Special about why the media and social media buzz about this incident raises some disturbing questions and offers a critical teaching moment around consent and boundaries. Stay tuned for some provocative conversations. On the heels of a news report detailing the account of a young woman photographer's date with Aziz Ansari and how it quickly degenerated into a harrowing night for her, social media has exploded with both self-proclaimed feminists and others critiquing both parties. But are there two sides, or just a culture of violence that is trying to pass off as normal and routine? What does this incident and the way people responded to it tell us about the culture of violence and silence we live in? How do we hold our male feminist allies accountable? What are the uncomfortable gaps in our understanding of complex ideas around consent that incidents like these prompt us to learn and unlearn? How can we erase toxic misogyny and patriarchy and proactively build the world we want to live in? One of authentic consent and freedom for all bodies to explore their desire and sexuality without stigma, fear of violence, or judgment. How can nuanced feminist analysis translate to lived reality? These are some of the questions tonight's show hopes to touch upon. By now, many of you would have read and may have followed the social media debates around Aziz Ansari's Date Gone Wrong, published on the site babe.net. The graphic description details from the perspective of his date, a young woman, as narrated to the journalist who broke the story. The story lit up social media in less than 24 hours and spawned heated debates, discussions, and hurled criticism against both Ansari and the young woman. While it was relatively easy to be disappointed and upset the way Ansari behaved, according to the article, especially given his self-anointed identity as a male feminist and ally, women and self-proclaimed feminists attacking the young woman caught more radical and progressive feminists unawares and stirred a digital battle of words, attacks and slurs, reminding us all over again that we are far from having any consensus on the ideas around consent. So we begin tonight's show with a conversation with noted feminist author, educator, storyteller and healer, Amita Swadin. Amita is a Just Beginnings Collaborative Fellow and the founding director of Mirror Memoirs, a storytelling and organizing project centering LGBTQ people of color who survived child sexual abuse. Amita is based in Los Angeles, but they travel frequently as a speaker, trainer, and consultant nationwide, and is no stranger to KPFA's airwaves. So thank you for being back with us, Amita.
Thanks so much for having me back, Preeti.
When you read the story about the Aziz Ansari date gone wrong, what was your response? You posted a powerful status message on your Facebook page. Tell us about your response as somebody who's been working on these issues when you read the story and the buzz and the debates around it on social media.
Well, I think, first of all, in terms of Aziz Ansari and, you know, how he gets seen in our media, and I think especially in our South Asian community as a good guy and a feminist, I think a lot about his past work that he has put out into the public arena around rape culture. And the story reminded me immediately that in his 2013 stand-up show, Buried Alive, he has a whole segment about child sexual abuse in which he is, I guess he thought he was joking about how cute he was as a child and essentially how rapeable he was as a child. And I thought it was incredibly in bad taste and very much at the expense of survivors. So when the story came out that here was a man who had been incredibly lauded in the public sphere, but who perhaps does not understand consent at all, it was not surprising to me. I think In the larger picture, though, I think this is really an illustration of how rape culture functions. You know, I think we are so trained to think about legality and what would stand up in a court of law as being constituting sexual assault that is prosecutable. And sexual assault is so much broader than that. It's really, to me, about a shift in our culture in which people are getting enthusiastic, verbal, very clearly negotiated consent that really centers everybody's pleasure. You know, are people actually present? Are they embodied? Are they having a good time? And that's a very newer way culturally of thinking about what sex is and what sexual encounters should be. And so to me, it really spoke to how far we have to go to get to a point in which every single one of us who is sexually active understands how to negotiate that with another human being, including human beings who we are on a date with for the first time. And that's a skill set. And I think it's a skill set that's hard to access in a society that is so sexually repressed, but at the same time, so sexually violent, because of how many of us come to the table in our sexual encounters, either never having been taught about consent, never having been taught about pleasure is and what we enjoy, having room to explore what we enjoy, having room to think about what might give our sexual partners pleasure. And then, of course, the fact that so many of us are survivors, particularly survivors of child sexual abuse, who had our boundaries violated well before we even knew what boundaries were and that we had a right to enforce them. And so it really begs the question of how do we start to shift the dialogue around sexual violence away from an individual frame and towards a collective problem? To me, this is a collective cultural structural problem in which we all need to get better about learning how to engage with the notion of consent.
Right. And I think consent is a big hot button issue that has come up over and over. And a lot of self-proclaimed feminists who were critical of the young woman in this incident, it was very disturbing to see that while they were or may have been critical of Ansari, they were also equally or more critical of the woman. So leaving it down to individual choice, right? Like, whereas ignoring the larger culture of silence and rape culture that we are like steeped in. So given this reality, I mean, I think it's important that you point out that how Ansari's work was already problematic, whereas a lot of the mainstream media and in the mainstream public consciousness, he's a celebrated male feminist ally, right? So I think that's, I think, a pertinent point that you bring out. And also, so given that there are these, I thought this incident was a teachable moment, which is why I set aside what I had planned for the show for tonight and said, we need to talk about this and also talk to engage with those feminists who think that what happened was the woman's fault. And where do we begin to talk about looking at consent, rebuilding, you know, unlearning and rebuilding or relearning and work towards, you know, a more authentic culture of freedom? What are your thoughts on this, Amita? Somebody who's works with youth, who works with, you know, especially marginalized youth who are fighting these oppressive systems every day.
Well, I mean, I think it does start with, you know, education and really meaningful dialogues with people. I don't think that this cultural change will happen in internet debates. I think it happens in small circles of people who are able to be vulnerable and honest about what they have really experienced or where generational trauma might come into their families. I mean, the fact is, in our society, if you're not directly a survivor of sexual violence, someone who's in your incredibly close, intimate circle, a parent, a sibling, a best friend, a lover, somebody that you love and care about is a survivor. That's just the epidemic nature of this violence. And so what's such a stark contrast is the silence around this issue, as you point out. Even though it is happening at epidemic rates, we don't have epidemic level of dialogue about it until very, very recently. And so there's a lot of toxic, repressive, victim-blaming culture to unearth and purge. You know, one of those values is really around who is the onus on, who is the burden on, and what does consent really look like? I mean, many women, particularly in generations older than mine, but, you know, of course, values get passed on. So I know there are also younger women who believe this, believe that the burden is on in heterosexual sex, I should say, right? Because this is a completely heterosexist frame. For me as a queer woman, the most of the mainstream dialogue around sexual violence has been around a cisgender man raping or sexually assaulting or crossing the boundaries of a cisgender woman. And I mean, in queer communities, we know that sexual assault crosses all kinds of gender spectrums because our relationships and the people that we have sex with are not a heterosexual equation. So we should just name that. But in a heterosexual framework, I think a lot of women still believe that the burden is on a woman to say no verbally and get up and leave a situation if she's not enjoying herself. Well, that's not actually in line with the neurobiology of trauma. What we know about the brain from neurobiology of trauma, the field of the neurobiology of trauma, is that many trauma survivors, when they get triggered, when they feel uncomfortable, particularly if they were raped or sexually assaulted over a long period of time as a young person, but even if they were sexually assaulted once, sometimes the way that a body internalizes that is just to shut down and acquiesce and just to endure and tolerate. And that's a survival skill when an assault is happening. But what often happens when somebody who you're trying to have consensual, pleasurable flirting with, making out with, that you don't necessarily want to have sex, if someone crosses your boundaries and escalates the sexual activity without getting direct, enthusiastic, clearly stated verbal consent, is you might not have the ability to verbally say no because you might be going into a triggered reaction in which your body and your brain are shutting down because you're a survivor of prior sexual violence. So I think, to me, that is why I really am aligned with the frame of affirmative consent as the only way to have mutually consensual, very clearly pleasurable, enthusiastic sexual experiences, is we have to change the burden to be on whoever is escalating sexual activity, right? If two people are having a sexual encounter, whichever person wants to take the encounter, let's say two people are making out and one of them wants to take it to the next level and take somebody's our item of clothing off, the burden is on that person, regardless of their gender, to say to their intended partner, I would really like to take your shirt off right now. Is that okay with you? And, you know, a lot of people say, well, that's clunky, that's not sexy. But the fact is, there are lots of ways to do that in a way that can be exciting and incorporated into foreplay. That's what a lot of sexual health educators teach about in workshops throughout the country, you know, how to talk dirty in bed, for example, in a really mainstream frame. Often what we're saying during those times is, how do you talk to your partner in a way that's sexy and exciting, but is actually a tool of getting verbal consent from them? And I think for a lot of women, that's like a totally new way of thinking about sex as something in which you can be that empowered and in which your sexual partner is actually that responsible. And of course, you know, the other thing that we hardly ever talk about in this country is how often substance use plays into our sexual encounters. I mean, that was something I even wrote about in my post about my own past behavior years ago before I got sober, is that alcohol and marijuana are often involved in people's sexual encounters. And if you're not lucid, you're not actually able to give or obtain really enthusiastic, clear, unequivocal verbal consent.
Absolutely. And I think you're raising some really wonderful points around how we can build this culture of, you know, educating ourselves to behave differently with our partners or lovers. And I think it's especially important in this day and age of online dating and random hookups. There is no, you know, there's no context for where how these hookups are unfolding, especially in a culture where, you know, many men are not even socialized in a cis heteronormative context, not even socialized how to talk or behave with women, forget how to be intimate, right? So it's actually a major problem, as I talk to a lot of young feminists. And given the fact that we live in, you know, what the pornification of culture, as they say, around how mainstream, you know, porn has become such a mainstream consumed thing that has really posing additional challenges around healthy sexuality, I think. So I think there are challenges on many fronts as technologies emerge that we have to really address, I think, proactively, as also you were saying. Coming back to, you know, your powerful post, I was wondering, would you bear with me while I read a few clips from it, so we can go back to our conversation?
Sure.
I have never been accused of sexual assault, but that doesn't mean I've always had explicitly negotiated verbal consent to do something I did. Most of my lovers have been fellow child sexual abuse survivors. Nearly all have been fellow childhood trauma survivors. 100% have been people living within patriarchy and rape culture. That's not because I'm a survivor. It's because we live in a world in which at least 20% of people were sexually assaulted as children, and many more as adults, and arguably even more were abused in some way, emotionally, physically, verbally, before the age of 18. Most of us experience our boundaries being violated in some way before we even know we have boundaries or the right to enforce them. Most of us start having sex well before we understand consent or how to obtain it explicitly, verbally, and even playfully and joyfully. And you go on to, you know, really break it down very, you know, clearly and powerfully. So coming back to what you were talking about earlier, Amita, we need to talk about this as in a contextual frame, right? Which I think, which is why the work that you do is powerful and important. It's not happening ahistorically without a context. It's clearly a pattern of abuse and cycles of violence that we need to break. So can you speak to that more, the context of the work that you've been doing, some of which we have had you talk about on our earlier shows, but I think is always beneficial to new audiences and also to, in this particular context of the Ansari incident?
Absolutely. I think when we talk about shifting rape culture, I always start with the issue of child sexual abuse. Again, not only because I'm a survivor of that particular form of sexual violence, but because it is so prevalent and it is such an early experience for people in which they are learning about violence and they are learning about what it feels like to have their boundaries violated and to have no agency before they ever learn about how to protect their boundaries, before they ever learn about what they enjoy as a human being, before they ever learn about how to assert themselves. And so if that is the cultural context of experience, of shared experience that so many of us are moving through, and yet we don't have the language to even say that to a potential lover, to say, hey, I'm a survivor, I might have X, Y, and Z triggers, just so you know, and to not be shamed for that, right? To not have someone think that then there's something wrong with us. That's the reason so many survivors stay silent, is because of the shaming process that happens from so many people who they disclose to, right? We have so much work to do around restructuring and rewiring the cultural narrative around what it means to be a survivor and where does the shame actually belong. Does it belong on the survivor or does it belong on the person who actually raped or sexually assaulted a child or a peer? And I really think there's a reason that so much of the work that child sexual abuse survivors who are pushing back against rape culture are doing is around pleasure activism, to use a term coined by my colleague Adrienne Marie Brown. You know, Adrienne talks as a sexual violence survivor about the importance of reclaiming our pleasure. Ignacio Rivera, who is a colleague of mine in my Just Beginnings Collaborative Fellowship and is publicly out as a transgender survivor of child sexual abuse, who is a person of color, their entire body of work over the past 20 years is around teaching people how to negotiate consent and how to have really pleasurable, really fun sex. You know, Bianca Loriano, another friend of mine who's a Mirror Memoirs participant, who is a national sexual health educator, queer woman of color, spends her entire career helping people write curriculum around sexual pleasure and sexual health education and consent and pleasure. So the list goes on and on. There are so many of us doing this work. And I think these two issues go hand in hand, right? We need to acknowledge that many people, like Aziz Ansari, and I'm sure many of your friends, many of my former lovers, maybe myself at times, like it's not about who's a good person and who's a bad person and who's a rapist and who's not. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be held accountable for the individual experiences and instances in which we might have sexually assaulted someone, inadvertently or not. Do I think what Aziz Ansari did to that woman was some form of sexual assault? Yes, I do, because he did not obtain enthusiastic, explicit verbal consent. However, I don't think he did it intentionally. Do I think that he deserves to be held accountable by her and in conversation with her to hear her out and get her needs met as someone he directly violated? Yes, I do. But do I think that means we should all throw him away as a quote-unquote rapist? No, because the larger issue is that most of us don't know what the hell we're doing when we are trying to have sex with somebody. We have never been taught what pleasure looks like. We have never been taught what consent enthusiastically looks like. And we have certainly never been taught how to negotiate verbally with another human being to get our sexual desires and needs met in a way that also works for them. Because we've never even been taught how to say the words, I was hurt sexually before. I was hurt in a violent way. This happened to me. I can't tell you how many survivors I have sat down with over the last 10 or so years who have told me experiences of surviving sexual violence and then followed it up with the sentence, I've never said this out loud to anyone before. I mean, so many. That's incredibly common. So if that's the context that we're working within, I think the point of my post is that this isn't about hunting individual rapists and putting them to the death. It's about realizing that most of us don't actually know what consent is or how to obtain it. And we need to start admitting that and start sharing resources with each other in which we can learn and role play consent, you know, I mean, with your clothes on in a spoken workshop with somebody, what would it feel like to actually sit and try to talk about what you're looking for sexually and how to get it in an experience with someone else that is also enjoyable for them? And of course, that means we need to start by giving ourselves room to explore our own bodies and our own pleasure so that we can even know what it is that we enjoy to begin with and that what we might want to do with another human being.
Absolutely. I think, those of us who have been doing anti-violence work, be it domestic violence or rape counseling, we need to really also step up and be proactive around what are the positive models of healthy relationships and healthy sexuality that we should be promoting and building and teaching. I think that's a very important point. Coming back to this issue, Amita, I was wondering if you also felt that, as somebody who works with youth, if there is a generational divide in some of the conversations that came about, both the New York Times piece and the Atlantic piece represented, I thought, sort of an generational divide between how older women and some of them self-proclaimed feminists looked at the whole incident and incidents like this, whereas a younger generation of feminists were clearly appalled both by this response as well as the incident itself. And I thought that was striking because it's a lot of it spoke to the internalized misogyny, right? In terms of how this is so normalized that this was seen as making a big deal. So what are your thoughts on this?
You know, it's always difficult to speak in broad generational terms because I know plenty of older feminists who I look up to who seem very aligned with the culture of enthusiastic, active, verbal consent that I'm advocating for, affirmative consent. And then there are plenty of younger women who are, I mean, look at our president's daughter. You know, I wouldn't exactly call her incredibly progressive, but she is younger than me. So it's tough to talk in terms of generational terms. I do think that there has been a shift in a larger number of younger women because of things like Tumblr and social media, blogging, just creating tools for a wider range of dialogue or dialogue with a wider reach. It's different than when I was growing up, you know, during the time of like dial-up AOL chat rooms. the level of dialogue you're able to engage in from your cell phone now is much broader. So perhaps that is the effect. But I do want to caution us around thinking purely in terms of generational frames because, you know, that's just obviously very simplistic. I did think that the New York Times and Atlantic articles were incredibly problematic, and I have appreciated the blogosphere kind of response where people are clearly seeing that although this is not a quote-unquote prosecutable crime, perhaps we need to move away from second-wave feminism. And I think largely it needs to be said a largely white feminism that many Asian Americans also align ourselves with, not myself, but many Asian Americans who are practicing what they think is quote unquote feminism, it's just not an intersectional enough feminism. I mean, we have been taught in second wave white feminism and the feminism of color that attaches itself to that theory that the carceral system is the way to respond to rape and sexual assault. And that's a huge part of the problem, right? Women who are thinking like all real rape is the kind of rape that you can lock someone up in bars about. That's the problem, right? All sexual assault being tied to the carceral system, it's not only incredibly violent against people of color who are disproportionately affected by the carceral system, like Black people, Indigenous people, Latinx, low-income people, low-income Asian Americans too, of course, it must be said, you know, and the fact that prisons themselves are a site of sexual violence. People get raped disproportionately in prisons. Why, if we are actually against sexual violence, would we believe that that would ever be a solution to the problem of rape and sexual assault? So that's, to me, a huge part of what's behind the problematic analysis of like, well, this wasn't really rape, this wasn't really sexual assault, is like, yeah, I guess in terms of the law, but in terms of consent, it certainly was a violation of this woman's consent. She makes that very clear in the Babe piece. And Aziz Ansari doesn't seem to understand that. He doesn't seem to understand that as someone who was escalating the level of sexual activity, he failed to get verbal consent from her. And that's the larger cultural problem that I was speaking to.
Right. And also for those who did look up to Ansari as some kind of a male feminist ally, there was the additional anger, which is justified, that, you know, he is someone who has made millions of his so-called feminist politics. And here was this incident kind of exposing him not living those values. Right. So there was that extra disappointment and anger also. But I also hear you when you say that his work was problematic to begin with. So let's now, you know, he was not a hero to begin with. So that's a crucial point that you point out. And also, I stand corrected. I think it's not a generational divide so much as what has been deeply internalized and what gets manifested, right? So younger women also have spoken out against the young woman. Why didn't she go home? Why did she go home to his place? And so on and so forth, which really gets to these internalized, issues around his internalized misogyny and accepting the culture as is. I was also wondering, for me, as somebody who lives and works a lot with the progressive community, be it here in India or in the US, I think these kind of incidents also expose the fact that it's one thing to have a powerful rhetoric and a value system that you articulate, but it's quite something else to live it, right? And I think that divide we see and that hypocrisy we see, right? It happens over and over around social justice activists. So for me, that was not surprising, but it's a constant reminder that living your values is far harder than articulating it. I find that in India, a lot of women who don't call themselves feminists are actually really feminist in the way they live and the way they work. Whereas it may not be true for those, you know, who do claim feminism as an identity, for example. So I think for me, that was something pertinent to remind myself. Do you have any thoughts on that? Just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I do shy away from identity politics at this point in my life a bit. You know, I mean, my political bonds and friendship bonds with people who happen to also be queer South Asian femme people who identify as some kind of intersectional feminist, when I authentically like align with those people in terms of our actions showing up in the same way, thinking about interdependence in the same way, that bond is probably the strongest kind of bond I have in my life. But I have learned through so much political heartbreak over the years that assuming that just because someone is South Asian and says they're a feminist means that we're going to have a ton of things in common or live our lives in similar ways is true is actually just a setup. And I think Aziz Ansari is a great example of that, right? He says that he's aligned with feminism. He's South Asian American, just like I am, but he doesn't seem to understand consent or how to honor survivor leadership or survivorship at all. And like I said, I think his 2013 work showed that to us a long time ago. So I'm not surprised at all that it has come out that he didn't know how to negotiate active, enthusiastic consent with one of his sexual partners in his private life. It's just not surprising to me.
Right. And even Master of None, that has won a lot of accolades, had a few problematic episodes that kind of revealed, some of these issues around consent and around boundaries, I think. So anyway, not to dwell too much on Ansari's work, but moving on to the larger, issues that this does raise, what does healing look like and what does justice look like as we work, proactively towards building a culture that enables, the sexual freedom of all bodies without fear of violence, stigma, or judgment? What would that look like to you, somebody who's already begun to do that work in your own, the work that you do and in the analysis and the writings that you have been doing?
Thank you for that question. I think the reason I started Mirror Memoirs with a focus on LGBTQ people of color who survived child sexual abuse is I find that we still are not at a point of even being able to acknowledge all survivors, the humanity and the existence of all survivors. Currently, the mainstream Me Too sexual violence conversation, again, focuses on the violence of cisgender men towards cisgender women. That sole focus of the lens erases anyone who was sexually assaulted by an adult woman when they were a child. It erases anyone who was sexually assaulted by a woman as being another woman. It erases anyone who was sexually assaulted by a man while being a man. I mean, there's so many survivors who are erased in that singular narrative, right? So I don't think that we can talk about collective healing until we can at least acknowledge the full extent of collective survivorship. And I think that's where we're at in the work, is we still can't even see all survivors, let alone thinking about healing together. Beyond that, though, I do think the conversation around consent is inherently one around pleasure and around destigmatizing survivorship. Right? There is a reason. Again, I can't emphasize this enough. There is a reason that so many survivors do not tell their potential or current sexual partners that they are survivors. I have experienced this myself in my own sex life, where I have said to a lover, this is what I lived through, and then gotten punished for it, right? We weaponize people's trauma against them. We say, well, you're damaged. There's something wrong with you. You're broken. I mean, these really false, terrible narratives, instead of having the collective consciousness that sexual violence is incredibly common. I grew up thinking my own experience was exceptional, and I have grown up into adulthood to realize the horror, and the reality is that it's actually quite common. It's a terrible reality, but if we want to change it, we have to be able to acknowledge it, right? Acknowledge how common sexual violence is. Acknowledge that there's nothing wrong with a survivor saying to someone, this is what I've lived through and what I'm healing from, and be able to have a culture in which survivors are not pathologized. And until we can do that, we're not going to really have a culture in which people can actually negotiate pleasurable consent that includes the room to talk about any potential triggers. You know, as long as people are being pathologized for the violence that they've survived, how is someone supposed to say to a lover or a potential lover, just so you know, if we're going to make out and you touch me in this way, it might trigger me, right? We have so much work to do around destigmatizing survivorship, and also more role plays, more classes, more education on how to use your words to obtain consent in any interaction with somebody's body. And then also like room to explore pleasure as a concept in your own body. What does pleasure look like? Really giving people the freedom to masturbate and enjoy it. I mean, someone online in something that I was reading was rightfully pointing out that Bill Clinton, when he was president, fired his Surgeon General, Dr. Joycelyn Elders, for encouraging masturbation. I mean, that was only what, like 20, 5 years ago. That's insane that we live in a world in which we don't even know how to encourage people to enjoy their own bodies. So I'm pretty clear about what the work is, and also very clear that this is long-term work because these issues are so big, and because our culture is so interlaced with patriarchy and stigmatization of survivors and complete sexual repression that breeds sexual violence, because that's what happens when you silence conversations around sex and pleasure.
Right. And I think the spaces are now slowly opening up, as you were pointing out. Like, I think we still have a long way to go, but I think these kind of conversations are beginning to open up, and you know, mainstream media is still very problematically focused on sensationalizing incidents more than analysis like this, which is why I think these conversations are important. And I think the whole issue of stigma, the stigma that survivors face around violence, I really struggle with that too. It's like, where do we start to do that work, right? Shifting the stigma from the survivor to the perpetrator. The work is a long haul. Are there resources that you could point us to, Amita, so those of our listeners who want to continue to be engaged on this issue can find more and learn more and read more?
Absolutely. If people go to justbeginnings.org, that website lists all of the fellows who are people of color who are child sexual abuse survivors and their projects. And I would recommend, there's 8 of us in the fellowship, and I just really think all 8 of us are doing our own individual projects that together sort of fit the larger scope of how big this work is. So Ignacio Rivera's work is around sexual pleasure and around sexual education, and they raised their child as a single parent, and now they have a podcast. Their child's in their mid to late 20s now, and Ignacio's in their 40s, and they have this beautiful podcast called Pure Love, which talks about how Ignacio, as a single parent who is a survivor of generational sexual violence, broke that cycle in raising their daughter, and how they raised their daughter to know about consent and pleasure and sexual healing. And so, often people are like, well, I don't understand how to do it. I would totally recommend watching that online show or listening to the podcast. And, if your work is around accountability and how do you do that lovingly with the people who probably you know intimately, Mia Mingus, her work, The Living Bridges Project, is about using transformative justice away from the carceral system, away from the prison system, to as an intervention in cases of sexual violence. And Aisha Shahida Simmons' work, Love with Accountability, is also about using storytelling as a way to unearth sexual violence in a way that is compassionate but still firm. So there's so many great resources out there, but I would recommend any of my colleagues in the Just Beginnings Fellowship for sure.
To begin with, at least as a start, right?
Right.
So thank you so much. I hope to bring you back for future conversations as these issues are not going to go away or get fixed overnight. As much as we would love to, this generation of us spoiled by technology, wanting to have a quick fix for everything, this is a long haul, right? So thank you for reminding us.
Yeah, this is absolutely intergenerational work. So I'm happy to be invited back. Thank you for continuing the dialogue and having that frame for the long arc. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Amita.
Thanks, Preeti. Take care.
So that was a discussion I had with Amita Swadhin, a noted educator, healer, storyteller, feminist, author, talking to us about the unpacking the Aziz Ansari incident.
My body, my mind, my choice. To wear the clothes I like even as my spirit roams naked. My choice. To be a size 0 or a size 15. They don't have a size for my spirit. And never will. To use cotton and silk to trap my soul is to believe you can halt the expansion of the universe. Or capture sunlight in the palm of your hand. Your mind is caged, let it free. My body's not. Let it be. My choice. To marry or not to marry. To have sex before marriage. To have sex outside of marriage. To not have sex. My choice. To love temporarily or to lust forever. My choice. To love a man or a woman or both. Remember, you are my choice. I'm not your privilege. The bindi on my forehead, the ring on my finger, adding your surname to mine, they're ornaments. They can be replaced. My love for you cannot. So treasure that. My choice. To come home when I want. Don't be upset if I come home at 4 a.m. Don't be fooled if I come home at 6 p.m. My choice. To have your baby or not. To pick you from 7 billion choices or not. So don't get cocky. My pleasure may be your pain. My songs, your noise. My order, your anarchy. Your sins, my virtues. My choices are like my fingerprints. They make me unique. I am the tree, not the forest. I am the snowflake, not the snowfall. You are the snowflake. This is my choice.
That was a clip by noted Bollywood actor Deepika Padukone reciting a poem titled Vogue. Up next, we will feature some commentaries by an intergenerational mix of South Asian feminists who shared their reflections and analysis, quick analysis around the Aziz Ansari episode. Up next, Swati Rayasam, a South Asian American feminist and a scientist by training who has worked in sexual assault, immigration rights and queer rights, shares with us this commentary drawing from her personal experiences in the light of the Ansari debate.
I think that the overarching lesson from this is that we all need to be more thoughtful about our experiences, and we need to really take a serious look at what we as a society are not understanding with regard to consent. You know, I had this experience myself with a man I went on a date with, and we had a very clear conversation about what we were looking for and about consent, where in no uncertain terms, he was looking for one thing and I was looking for another thing. And we parted apparently as friends, and mere hours later, he's texting me to push the boundaries of my consent like it's a game to him and not a decision that I made. And the problem was that he was hearing me before, but he wasn't listening. And women need to feel more empowered to speak up and call out coercive behaviors in men. And men, for the very first time, need to be able to truly listen to us, you know? And as I said before, I think that all men do this and all men have been conditioned to do this. And I hate that people feel like if they're part of this problem, you know, if they have ever exhibited this behavior, that they're exempt at all from consideration of achieving the solution. And it's like, I have thought some terrible, terrible things before, and I have just been shitty to people. And I was called out, and I took a second, readjusted, and I'm trying to do good, you know. I have minimized my experiences, and I have heard men that I love and I know say things that I feel are predatory and objectifying, and let it slide because we as a society expect boys to be boys. But all of us are not only not exempt from the solution, we are a key part to achieving the solution. None of us are perfect. And the sooner that we realize that we do not have to be perfect, the faster we can start to get to work.
That was Swati Raisun's commentary. Up next, another commentary by Bangalore, India-based feminist Sushmita Sundaram.
So I'd like to talk about something that is bothering a lot of people about reaction to the babe piece, which is whether this is a bad date or sexual assault. Up front, I do think this is sexual assault, at the very least. There was clear discomfort communicated, verbal and non-verbal, which is when everything should have stopped, regardless of whether Grace stayed or left. There might be people who feel like she's not being forceful enough, but think about how people actually sound when they speak together, the signals they send out and how we receive them. saying, hey, you need to chill in conversation is as direct as saying, hey, stop. This is the parlance in relationships, because when you go on a date, you're hoping to meet someone lovely who will see you for who you are, will find you interesting and wonderful. You hope you will meet someone you find fascinating, who shows you new things, but still finds the things you're into interesting. It's an endeavor you go into with an open heart, not one you approach with defensiveness. So you put your best foot forward, hoping for the best, even when things don't feel entirely right. And you hope they will become entirely right if you just say the right combination of things. And that's why I think people, when reading her story, might feel like she wasn't being forceful. But to me, in the context that it wasn't, she was being forceful. So I have a friend who read about this incident, and he said that he felt that this was just confusing to him. He wasn't sure how to interpret the entire situation. He wasn't sure whose side he was on. Something he pointed out that he felt was interesting was that right after Ansari was done pleasuring his date, she went cold. He mentioned it seemed manipulative, off-putting, that he has been on dates where women have said, no, I just want to make out, and then made fun of him for not being more of a man who went for it. And we all have that one friend, or maybe we have been that one friend, who says, you know, I just want a man's man. I want a macho, old school guy who knows what he wants and he goes for it. Confidence is always seen as sexy. But I think this is what is confusing to a lot of people who see this entire interaction as a bad date. They feel like Grace was being disingenuous, or that these were just crossed wires. But I think it's because of lost nuance in the retelling of what happened, where aggression is being confused for passion. This, in my opinion, is because these two emotions are often depicted in the same way, especially in media, which is where most of us learn what love is, especially when we're young. Passion is a recognition of what someone else wants, and for flirtation to be tailored to those desires. Inherently, it's unselfish. You're getting off on the idea of deeply understanding what someone wants and needs, and of someone else understanding what you want and you need. It's when you make a self-deprecating joke on like that first or second date, when you say, I know I was your last choice for a drinking buddy on a random Thursday. And he comes back with, you stick to that story if you'd like, but we both know it's because I couldn't wait until Saturday to see you. That's passion, because he's understood that you thought you were like just a random person that he's, you know, drinking next to. But he's expressed that he wants you. Aggression, on the other hand, is wanting something and being pushy about it. It's inherently selfish, because you're not as concerned about giving people what they desire, but getting your own fulfilled. It's when someone who has told you, hey, let's chill, let's slow down, when you've been getting frisky with them. And you do, because you're a good guy. And then you think, man, she's so hot, she's still here, she's cuddling with me. I think I should try again. Like, maybe if I just make out with her, or maybe if I say enough, like, you know, sexy things to her, she's going to be into it. If you were one of those people who thought this was just a bad date, pause and question why. Is it because it mirrors so many of your experiences, and that makes you a bad person or a victim? If that's the case, think of this as an opportunity to introspect and come up with a game plan for future romantic interactions. Being more explicit about desire and intent does not make it less passionate, just less aggressive, less unwanted, less unsexy. So I have another friend. She's a woman in her 30s. She has this fantastic job in like a big organization. She has fun friends. I'm one of them, who like going out with her, and she likes going out too. And she does. She dates around a fair amount. So she told me something that I thought was very, very interesting. She said when she's been on a date that's gone well, she's like the guy, she can tell that he likes her, and she knows that he's probably going to go for a kiss. She'll kiss them back, but after a moment or two, she'll put her hand on their chest and gently push. And if he doesn't step away, if he gets pushy or he gets more aggressive, she won't go home with him, even if she liked him before that. If he does step away and then just, you know, continue the conversation they were having or say something nice to her and just let that moment remain, she'll probably go home with him. I find this interesting because as women, we have all of these little tests and little rules that we've created. Probably because we all live in constant assault or rape anxiety. But these little rules or little tests that we have for ourselves aren't necessarily bad. Sorry about that, Preeti. Anyway, so I'll restart where I left off, which is these little tests or rules that we've created for ourselves aren't necessarily a bad thing. They help you kind of navigate a date to figure out if you're getting what you want. And that's important, to put yourself at a higher priority, at priority where you listen to what you want and need. You approach a date in good faith. You're nice, you're kind, you're encouraging even. But don't forget to be those things to yourself before anyone else. It's work to build the gumption to get up and leave in an awkward, anxiety-inducing, sometimes even dangerous situation. But your comfort has worth and must be prioritized. Even if you're out on a date with someone you've liked for a while, and it might seem like there are just tiny things that have been off-putting, it's okay. You're worth not being put off. You're worth someone paying attention to these tiny details and realizing what you like and don't like. Your comfort is worth being prioritized. There are plenty of options out there, so don't double guess yourself. Get out if you want to, because getting out is the first step to going and meeting someone with whom you won't have to put in the work of being nice, the work of being kind, the work of being encouraging. They'll be able to see you for the lovely, interesting, exciting, cool person that you are. And that's what women deserve.
That was a powerful commentary by Sushmita Sundaram. Sushmita is a Bangalore-based freelance writer whose work focuses primarily about Indian pop culture, comedy, and feminism.
I think something that has stayed with me after reading the story in Babe, but also various other commentaries and op-eds on the Aziz Ansari episode, is that how much we really need to talk about empathy when it comes to sexual and intimate relationships. I think regardless of whether you are a feminist or not, it's really important that we are able to put ourselves in the shoes of our partner and also are able to empathize with them during you know, the course of a sexual encounter. And I think that is really key to being in tune with your partner and also then really being able to practice consent. And I think the other thing is that has also stood out to me really is the fact that when someone comes forward with their story, you know, regardless of whatever gender, the least we can really do at that point is to suspend our judgment and hear and acknowledge their story. I think our judgment about it, whether it's right or wrong, and really trying to jump at conclusions shouldn't really undermine the storyteller and their stories, because I think it's really important to understand that people and women in this case have diverse experiences when it comes to sexual consent, and what another woman might be experiencing is very different from what we might have experienced in our own life. So really trying to be cognizant of that and not jumping to conclusions and to make a judgment about a person, I think that is the least we can really do when someone comes forward with a story. And the last thing I would say that has stayed with me and something that I really would like everyone to do, regardless of your political or social stances on issues, is you know, using this as an opportunity to really reflect on how we can reimagine our most private, intimate relationships. I think we have talked a lot about consent, we have read a lot about it, but something that we can really do more is, you know, perhaps use this as an avenue to talk about really radically rethinking about our sexual relationships, to make them mutually pleasurable, mutually empowering, healthier and happier. And I think this is really a chance for us to be able to do that. I think we can't do that unless we, you know, get comfortable with these uncomfortable conversations, get comfortable with the dilemmas and conundrums that this story in particular has thrown at us. And I think it's really important then to, you know, make sure that we use this opportunity to be able to make it worthwhile and reach a better point where we are able to say that, yes, it has been uncomfortable, it has been awkward, it has been depressing, it has been perhaps devastating, but we are able to reach a point where we can, you know, talk about sex without getting judgmental, but also really talking about intimate relationships that are healthier, happier, and pleasurable, and of course consensual for anyone involved in that relationship.
That was a reflective commentary by young feminist Surabhi Srivastava, who works for a feminist nonprofit based in Delhi called Love Matters. And that's a wrap. We are at the end of tonight's special show. We hope we challenged some of your dearly held norms around consent and that many of you, our listeners, will be proactive feminists or allies in ending the silence and work proactively towards an authentic culture of sexual freedom. It is Swati Raisam from Berkeley, Anjali Nath from Santa Cruz, Sushmita Sundaram from Berkeley, Sheila Sampath from Toronto, and Amita Swadin from LA for sharing their valuable perspectives. A big shout out to our board op Mike Biggs and our show editor Subhu Shiva. I have been your host and producer Preeti Mangla Shekhar. Our theme music is by Asian Crisis. Tune back in next Thursday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Apex Express.